Hence and grass. Ka eat with the shoe ye, where kashuk are ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha anikak. Gunnish cheese.
From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, August 20th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, Gunnath Cheesh, Hawa, Tuxuk Nusum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Instagram and Facebook pages. Conversations coming up this hour, a preview of this weekend's Jammy Jam, a celebration in honor of 40 years of Jammy health and wellness here in Juneau. In this week's Garden Talk, we learn how to make the most of your precious harvests. And school is back in session, and if you have a wee one, you have options too. Juno Montessori, a tuition-based nonprofit school, offers preschool services to children ages 16 months to 6 years old. What is Montessori and how do you get your kiddo enrolled? Well, I have Laura Talpe here in the studio, executive director of Juno Montessori School over in Douglas. Thank you so much, Laura. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Nice to meet you. Wasiti, how you doing?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me, Boston. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to learn a little bit about Montessori.
Yeah.
So let's start there because people hear different terms, Montessori, Waldorf, charter school, different. I have all these options and I'm a new parent and I know I have to get enrolled to school at some point, but preschool's possible and there's all these choices. And what's Montessori?
That is such a good question. And there are so many options out there. And there's no trademark on the word Montessori. So anyone can open a Montessori school, call it a Montessori school. It doesn't have to have anything to do with Montessori, but you can call yourself that if you want to. So I'll just say that. But Maria Montessori was the first female Italian physician, and she was alive from 1870 to 1952. And after she became a physician, she started working with children with special needs, and she had a classroom of children. And, you know, these were children who weren't, who were disinvited from other schools and, you know, everyone didn't know what to do with these kids. And she worked with them and built a classroom that was designed to feel a lot like the home. And it was called the Casa dei Bambini, which means the house, the children's house or the house of the child. So she used real materials, wood, glass, metal, and she gave children real work. So instead of having them, you know, sit down and do worksheets or just play, she would have them polish shoes or sweep the floor or fold laundry. And then along with that, she designed really interesting materials in math and language and geography, and she built an entire curriculum. And over the last 100 years, her method has become popular, and it's you can find Montessori schools in almost every country across the world. And there are different organizations that accredit Montessori schools in slightly different ways. But the big idea is that in a Montessori program, we design a prepared environment for children that allows them to have the most independence that they can have during the day. So everything is at their level, it's their size, it's for them, and it's real. So it's designed to connect them to the real world and allow them to participate in the world of adults rather than, you know, doing something that's just for kids. Because children really want to help. They, you know, if I don't know if you I don't know if you have kids, Boston, but
I'm grown now.
You gotcha. When yeah. So when they were young, did they ever want to help you like cook dinner?
Of course.
Yeah, clean
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What are you doing, Dad?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then were you ever tempted to just be like,
I want that help.
There you go. So we love that kind of parent.
Yeah.
Children love to help. And so we try to involve them as much as possible in those chores because that's really what they're after. They want to be with you. They want to connect with you and do the things that you're doing.
Mm. I see. Yeah, I to full disclosure, my daughter was a Waldorf kid.
Ah.
So mm-hmm. We went that route and it was fantastic. And it's just another option, another, mm-hmm. you know, theory, a different way of doing things. And I think one thing I think people may have heard about Montessori, because you described it a little bit there, and that was probably the best description I've ever heard in terms of the history of it and all that. So thank you, because how it got designed in the first place is really important, knowing that history. And I think today how people think of it sometimes is, you know, oh, they have stations that mm-hmm. they go to. Like there's no first period is, you know, geography and second period is math. And it's like, no, it's like, what are you feeling like you want to do today? And then going from there. So is that something that applies to, because I know we're talking today really about the youngsters mm-hmm. when you're just sort of getting them involved, getting mm-hmm. them out of the house and, getting them going mm-hmm. into, the program. So is it designed a little bit differently for preschoolers? How does that work? I mean, yeah, I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, that's a good question, and we get that kind of question a lot. So the way it works is there are different areas of the classroom. There's a math area, there's a language area, there's what's called a practical life area or a sensorial area. And these areas have, I mean, the classroom has shelves with materials on it, and the children are given lessons by their guide to work through these materials. And each material has a specific skill that it is working that the child acquires through mm-hmm. through doing that work. It's all called work in Montessori, but
right.
don't let that put you off too
okay,
much. It's
okay.
just the word we use. But so when the child comes in, they start their day with a 3-hour morning work cycle. So during that time, they're in the classroom, they're part of the community of other children who are there. The guide is there. The guide usually has an assistant or maybe two assistants there to help. And yes, the children they can choose what they want to do. And they might start with a little bit of math and then they might wash a window. They might do a little bit of reading with the sandpaper letters and then read a book or sing a song with a group. So they're sort of designing, they can choose what they want to do at different times of the day. But as children get older, there are more expectations. Like, well, you have to do some math today.
The structure starts to come into play, right?
Yeah, and so, you know, we let children still have some autonomy over how they structure their time. If they just don't feel like doing it right now, they can do it later.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to do it at some point today.
I see.
That would be
okay.
an example. So that is really where the guide has is observing the child and gets to know the children. And they create boundaries. So we call it freedom within limits.
Mm.
So we set some limits, and then the child has freedom within those limits. And, oh, maybe that's not working. We need to tighten up the limits a little bit. Or maybe we can expand the limits here a little bit. Because there are certain things that children need to accomplish, obviously. They
Right.
need to learn how to read. They need to learn how to recognize all their numbers and then add and subtract, multiply and divide by the time they're getting to kindergarten. So they have these skills that we want them to learn. But we also want them to develop a love of learning and an ability to have that executive function and be able to do for themselves.
Now, I know that Montessori is it's a paid situation. It's nonprofit, but you're mm-hmm. still tuition-based. You still
yeah.
have to pay something, which you would maybe be paying for daycare at the same time. But so what's the difference between, like, Montessori or the benefit of Montessori versus daycare for kids this young? Because we're starting this at, like, 16 months up mm-hmm. up to kindergarten age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of really great daycares in Juneau, but I think the difference with a Montessori environment, if that's what you want for your child, is that there's going to be a really hands-on approach. The lead teacher, who we call the lead guide, has received a pretty rigorous training in the Montessori method. Mm. They've written albums about, they know all about child development. They've spent 2 or 3 summers or an academic year working through this training. And they're going to be doing a hands-on teaching approach, really. So some daycares are like more play-based. You know, there's maybe, like you said, stations where there's like an art station, a sensory station, mm-hmm. And the children are sort of playing freely, going to from station to station. This is going to be more focused on helping your child be independent.
Okay.
So when at the 16-month age, we are teaching your child how to pull on their pants and take them off, put on their own shoes, put on their socks, wash their hands, care for themselves, set a table, use a fork and knife, those kinds of real world skills.
I see. Okay. Now I know that school is starting, and you have you're enrolling preschool age children now.
We are.
And you still have some room for certain ages, but then there's probably a wait list for other ages?
Yeah, so we have a couple of spots left at our 3 to 6 level.
Okay.
So we have mixed age groups. One of those age groups is 16 months to 3 years old. The other is 3 to 6 year olds. So at that 3 to 6 level, we have a handful of spots left.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have any space at the 16 months to 3 years old, and we have a long wait list. You should still get on the wait list if you're interested. But if you have a 3 or 4 or even 5 year old child who's not in kindergarten yet,
mm-hmm.
And you're looking for a place that's going to be educational and fun for your child, then you should definitely reach out to us.
And is there financial assistance, scholarships, things like that available?
Yeah, so we do have a scholarship program, and the scholarship application along with the waitlist application is on our website, junomontessorischool.org. And then we also take all kinds of assistance, state child care assistance, tribal assistance, Coast Guard assistance, things like that.
Okay, great. And this is all beginning, is it already started?
We had our first day of school yesterday.
Oh.
But that said, we enroll on a rolling basis.
Okay.
So you're not too late.
I see. Okay. And just final question before we wrap up today. I was just curious about, I was reading a little bit about your bio, but would you explain sort of your journey to Montessori and how you got to Juno?
Yeah, I would love to. So when I was in college, I studied developmental psychology, mm-hmm. psychology of the child. And I was working in a lab, a psychology lab, where we were studying different things. One of them was optimism in young children. And so we would visit different preschools and like run studies with children at different preschools. I went to college at Washington University in St. Louis. So I was in St. Louis. So I got to see a lot of different preschools. That was probably the origin of my interest in early childhood education. And then I spent some years after college working in a lab that studied public school funding and teacher salaries and how these things affect children's outcomes.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And then from there, I had a very good friend who had moved to Juno. And when the position opened up at Juno Montessori School, she reached out to me. And that is how I landed here.
Interesting. And how long have you been here?
It'll be 6 years in January.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And you've been at Juno Montessori that whole time?
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a wonderful school. It's over there in Douglas.
Yep.
Right
by Sandy Beach.
Right there. Every time you go down to Sandy Beach, you pass it.
You sure do.
For sure. There's still spots available in the 3 to 5 year old preschool program. The Montessori, what age do you go up to now? Because I know you were planning to try to get to 8th grade at some point.
Yeah, so Montessori Borealis, which is now Dezantakahini, they go up through 8th grade.
Oh, they do. Okay.
We go up through the kindergarten year.
Okay, you
so
go up through kindergarten.
So we have kindergartners.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
I see. Gotcha. Because I know that I remember when my daughter was in Waldorf, we were trying to figure out where she could go to high school. Because they don't keep going necessarily.
Right.
But the critical learning skills, all the things that you do gain from these programs last them in their regular schooling as well. So that's pretty cool. Laura Talpe, thank you so much for coming in. Gunnath Cheech for being here. Again, you can go to junomontessori.org. And you can find out all the information about enrolling for the 2025-2026 school year. And as Laura said, it is on a rolling basis, so you're not too late.
Thanks, Boston.
Thank you. Gunnar Cheech for being here. Okay. Up next, we're going to listen to this week's Our Living Lands. This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In June, President Trump withdrew the U.S. government from an agreement designed to protect salmon and renewable energy in the Columbia River Basin. In the aftermath of that move, Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spaulding spoez with Eric Holt, chairman of the Nez Perce Tribes Fish and Wildlife Commission, about the future of salmon in the region.
As chairman of the Nez Perce Tribes Fish and Wildlife Commission, how do you see climate change impacting our salmon runs today, and what worries you most about the next 10 to 20 years?
So climate change impacting salmon runs today. We see it, and the example that I'll use will be the Toucannon River. That's also a semi-quasi-extinction mode right now in terms of the returns of salmon and the warmth of the water itself. We saw the last 3 years, it's had less than 50 returning wilds, and so that has been categorized as a semi-quasi-extinct salmon stock. The fish themselves are smaller, and there's a lot of different contributing factors over time, but the one real huge one is climate change. And that's where we see that happening in the Toucannon as the example of the salmon runs that are dying and diminishing right before our eyes. And that's something that I feel deeply ashamed of. Not that it's a Nez Perce's fault, if you will, but just ashamed to see something go extinct in our lifetime, and something that, you know, has been such a, you know, hallmark for the Nez Perce. And that's, you know, speaking for, on behalf of the salmon, and knowing that climate change is having such a rapid impact on making those salmon runs decline is something that, you know, we need to get in front of and do what we can on behalf of the salmon, because we see it happening right before our eyes, the decline and the extinction all in one.
The tribe has long advocated for dam removal as a key part of salmon restoration. In your view, how critical is breaching the Lower Snake River dams for the survival of salmon in the face of warming waters and changing ecosystems?
For breaching of the Lower Snake River dams, since the early 2000s and even before, I remember as a young man talking and hearing stories from the older leaders that are no longer with us. You know, we've seen some minds and hearts change over time. So it's going to be a lot of interaction with other industries to ensure that every voice is heard as you go through the system of bringing down a dam. That water quality, the habitat, the spawning grounds, all those have been lost to the dams. And so that's something that we know is critical as we see that going forward. And we'll still keep the pressure on in terms of, you know, advocating for a breaching of the Lower Snake River dams.
Under the Biden administration, there was a historic agreement between the U.S. government and the treaty tribes in the Pacific Northwest over salmon protection and dams, but recently Trump withdrew from that agreement with the tribes. How will this impact the future of the salmon for these treaty tribes?
We were really disappointed what Trump has did, because what it did was there was a huge years of collaboration, coordination amongst all four tribes and two states that saw the future of saving salmon in a way that wasn't ever addressed before. And also at the same time, it was allowing for a platform for all of us to come together to voice our concerns and then continuing to do the collaboration with the entities that were involved. Not only was we upset and disappointed with it, but I felt the resiliency of the tribes. And then we need to make sure that, you know, collectively we have the one strong voice, one strong approach, and that we all understand that, you know, it's the future of the salmon that's at stake. So as we move forward, the CBRI, even though it's done in the eyes of the president, we know the treaty tribes will not stop at just hearing it from him. We'll continue to do our part to ensure that, you know, we are the advocates and speak on behalf of the salmon and all steelhead and lamprey and sturgeon.
What gives you hope right now? Are there any recent wins or partnerships that make you feel optimistic about the future of salmon and the ability to restore what was once so abundant in Nimitpu country?
What gives me hope is that we still have the coordination amongst the four tribes. And as a matter of fact, we have coordination amongst the First Nations in Canada. We have the Northwest Indian Fish Commission, the Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission. So we've reached out to other organizations within the United States and Canada that share the same sentiments and ideals and values and priorities that we have for salmon. Being optimistic about the future is tough in these times and these ages because of what Trump has done to the indigenous nations of the United States and beyond. And so, but what gives me hope is that we're strong, we're resilient, we've endured so much over time, and we need to continue to fight and be there for our future next 7, 14, 21 generations of the Nez Perce.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You are listening to community-supported Juneau Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juneau, 91.7 Juneau Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This Saturday, August 23rd, from 4 to 7 p.m., over at the Pioneer Pavilion in Douglas is the Jammy Jam, featuring local band The High Cost of Living and the Yate Yi Dancers. It's a free community concert to honor the 40 years of Jammy Health and Wellness, offering behavior and physical health care to everyone. I am joined now in the studio to talk about this a little bit more. I am here with Rachel Gearhart, who is the Chief Operating Officer. Gunith Chi Shwasiyati. How are you, Rachel?
I'm good. Thank you for having us.
Excellent. Welcome. And also joining us, a friend of the show, longtime visitor, first time caller. Not really. I love that when people say that. That's Taylor Dallas Vidic, who is helping Jammy in this 40th year as an event organizer for not just the Jammy Jam, which I love that name, by the way, because it makes me think of like getting into my Jammy Jams, you know, but other events that are happening previous as well as in the future from this event. Wasiyati Taylor, how are you?
So happy to be here, Boston.
Gunith Chish. Okay, thank you. And also, disclaimer, KTO is a media sponsor for this event, but this interview on Juneau Afternoon is not part of that agreement because Juneau Afternoon is open to the community. Mm. So let's start with you, Rachel, and let's just remind folks, I gave a little bit of a description there in the intro, but what is Jammy?
Yeah, Jammy is a community health provider for everyone, all ages. People may know us from our behavioral health services, which we've provided for a very long time. But more recently, we also have integrated primary care, so medical care. So you can really pull everything together in one spot, get your physical health, get your mental health, preventive care, all of that done in one spot.
So is it kind of like, it's not an urgent care center.
Correct.
It's a clinic though, right?
It's a clinic.
Okay. And you have a variety, because when sometimes people think of it as, mental health, mm-hmm. but you also do some physical.
We do. And while we're not urgent care, what I do want to say is we have a lot of availability. So when you call and say, I want to be a client, you're not going to get an appointment 3-6 weeks out for medical care. We're able to see people really quickly.
Okay, cool. And do you have to get referred to Jammy,
or can
you
self-referral?
Self-referral,
absolutely.
So you can walk in. And what's the website so people can, figure out what kind of services are available there?
Yeah, www.jamhi.org.
Wow. Okay. And does Jammy stand for something?
It used to stand for Juneau Alliance for Mental Health Incorporated, and now we've just gone with that name recognition. It's just Jammy Health and Wellness.
So you added the health and wellness to make it, I see.
Right, okay, it's not just mental health anymore.
Right.
It's really more inclusive, so it's Jammy Health and Wellness.
I see, okay. So, and why choose Jammy over some other option? Is there specialty areas?
While we do have some specialty areas like severe mental illness and substance use, those are some of our specialty areas. But really, we just think we provide a really welcoming, inclusive atmosphere. It's not too big. It's not too fancy. I'm not saying we don't provide high quality services, but we want to do it in a way that's really personable for people.
Yeah, and it's right over there by, it's by the hospital, right?
It is.
It's right there on the road across from the Twin Lakes Park.
Sure is. So yeah. We're right on the bus system. We're easily accessible.
I see. Okay. And we're celebrating 40 years of JAMI, health and wellness. How did it begin? Do we know?
We do know some of that, and that's part of what this 40th year is about, is capturing some of those stories so that we don't lose them before the people who helped create JAMI are no longer able to tell those stories. But it started with families who had children who were, you know, becoming adults, who were getting older, that they said, I don't know that I can provide long-term care. I want to help them become independent, and we need some support. We need more than advocacy. We need services, and they need help with things in particular like housing. Mm. These are folks who may not be able to be successful in an apartment on their own without support. So that's really how JAMI got started, is families who cared about their kids and needed more support.
How big is the staff over at JAMI?
We're just under 100.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And is it outpatient services only?
Outpatient services is definitely what we're known for, but then we have that housing.
Right.
So
okay.
It's not like inpatient or, you know, residential treatment like that, but it is service-enriched housing for people who...
I see. And is the housing for people who might be recovering from... drug addiction or something like that, or can it be a variety of things?
It's definitely for folks with severe mental illness, but they often also have a substance use issue as well.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's available. Is there like, do you get full?
We do, and we keep waiting lists, but anything can happen. So we encourage people who might be interested. Our housing application is on our website.
Okay.
And so that housing is a part of what we do. It's a little separate from our behavioral health in some ways. So we have a variety of levels of housing depending on what people need.
I didn't even know that that was part of it. So that's kind of cool to get the word out.
That's kind of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, trying to get the word out about like,
right, reintroduce ourselves.
Yeah. What other things do people not know about JAMI that we haven't already talked about?
Well, I just came from the therapeutic court today. We have a hand in being the treatment provider for our therapeutic courts in the community, which is not really a diversion program, but it's a way to rehabilitate and give people support so that they can become members of society who are engaged and in recovery. We also help with reentry services, people who are coming out of incarceration, lots of case management, which is helping people learn skills and things that maybe they don't know how to do or forgot how to do or just need help to learn, help with benefits, especially as all this kind of stuff changes with Medicaid, Medicare, what do I need to know? We try and stay on top of what the benefit structures are like so that we can help people apply for the right things, maintain them, keep up to date on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think on Friday we're having some folks on to talk about that upcoming panel.
Yes.
For all the changes in the healthcare system and what you need to know. So
yes.
Stay tuned for that. And Rachel, how did you get involved with JAMI?
I am a social worker, and I moved to Alaska in 2006, and I've been in Juneau since 2010, and this is, JAMI has been my Juneau place to land.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
You've been there a while.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. And whose idea was it to begin a 40th anniversary celebration?
Well, that was kind of some of the staff with our board realizing this is a good time to celebrate.
Yeah, to get the word out.
Get the word out, reintroduce ourselves, like you said. Mm-hmm. Maybe not everybody knows what we do, and maybe they have a narrow idea of what we do. So it was reintroducing ourselves, celebrating, and really honoring the past while we still have some of these people around who can tell us how it got started, what JAMI used to look like versus what it looks like now.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Taylor Dallas Vidic, how did you get involved in helping to craft this 40th anniversary celebration year?
Yeah, I have to thank Nami Erickson because she got reached out to possibly participate with this. And she said, I don't know if I'm the right person for you, but can I introduce you to Taylor? So shout out to friends and community connections.
Yeah.
And it has been such a joy and a bit overwhelming in the best way possible to be learning so much about JAMI. As someone kind of like you, Boston, a lot of the questions you're asking, Rachel, I didn't know the answers to. And so to have gotten to spend the last several months learning about the history of JAMI and this massive umbrella of care that they offer to individuals, and also like they're like a secret hero in my mind amongst Juno, taking care of our most vulnerable populations and doing so alongside the kind of care that we all need, which is so rad. So it's been a pleasure to get to help them celebrate this year.
That's cool. Okay. So I know we're going to talk about this JAMI Jam, but just quickly, you've already had one or two events already?
Yeah. So we did in March a kickoff on the actual incorporation day of JAMI. And we invited some of the founders who are still around, and we got to celebrate with them. We got a citation from the Juneau legislature or the
former
Alaska legislature.
Former board members, former staff participated.
Nice. Okay.
And got to say, hey, keep an eye out. We're going to keep throwing parties all year.
Yeah.
And we're invited.
That's awesome. Yeah. You helped us with the KTO's 50th anniversary big old party, too. You're just like a party organizer.
Yes. You caught me.
She's a party person and a storyteller. And that's what has really helped us is, I mean, Taylor mentioned not knowing all the details of JAMI has actually been a really great gift for us because she can help us identify what it is that we need to share.
Oh.
So that we're, because, you know, I might have a blind spot about that, whereas Taylor can help us see this is what the community might need to know.
Yeah, why aren't they knowing about this thing? And say, okay, let's rack that up
for sure.
A little bit. And then you did something like a month or so ago, was it? Did you do something?
There have been some JAMI give back days. So staff and employees have been, or employees and board members have been giving back to the community in various ways. So last week we were out at Zach Gordon Youth Center and helped clean up their gardens, both at the youth center and then out at the shelter as well. So part of my job has been connecting JAMI with other organizations as well
to celebrate
on a larger platform.
Okay.
We also participate in the 4th of July parade for the first time, I think, ever. That was kind of something that Taylor helped us with, too. You know, another opportunity to get out there. I don't think we'd ever done that before.
Why not make a float?
Oh, we had a float.
Oh, gosh, did they?
I was out of town on the 4th
this
year.
Me too, but we had a float, and I heard it was amazing.
Shout out to Travis Clark for building that.
Travis Clark, shout out. Okay, let's talk about this JAMI Jam. I have the flyer up for those who might be on the stream. It's a free community concert and picnic for all ages. It's featuring the High Cost of Living and the Yate Yi Dancers. Tell us a little bit about this event, Taylor Dallas Vidic.
First and foremost, I think, knocking on wood, that the sun is going to be out on Saturday. That's a really big deal. So we'll be out at Pioneer Pavilion at Sandy Beach, and the band has actually donated their performance. This is a free community concert where there are going to be meals provided for the first 200 folks who registered for the event. I must say that those 200 people have registered, but we are still asking more folks to register so that we kind of know how many people to accommodate or to expect.
Okay, do that at jammyjam.eventbrite.com.
Correct.
jammyjam.eventbrite.com. Just get that website out there. Okay.
Yeah, so free community concert with the High Cost of Living. The Yate Yi Dancers, Betsy Sims, is doing sound for the event. We're going to have food available from El Chignon and Four Plates. Juno Party Animals just signed on to do free face glittering and a tattoo station. Just imagine a really wonderful afternoon out at Sandy Beach surrounded by community. You're sitting in the grass. You can bring your own picnic supplies if you want. This is an all-ages event with music and dancing and, I don't know, a really wonderful way to, I don't want to say wrap summer, but to acknowledge that perhaps summer is starting to come to a close, so let's all get out while we can.
We're in the, what is it, the waning moments of summer?
The fireweed has come and is starting to leave, so.
Yeah. Oh, that's sad. It seemed like so short because it was so rainy at the beginning.
It was so bad. But Saturday it's going to be absolutely gorgeous.
Okay.
So.
No, not like today.
Not like today.
No. That's really good news. And I love that you mentioned that you're going to have Four Plates and El Chingon, which is so yummy.
Yes.
And that's going to be really good. Again, don't forget to register, even though the free meals that you were going to give out to the 200 people, those people have signed up, but you'd still love for people to sign up because you want to know how many people might be coming, and make sure there is enough extra food or available, right? Okay. That they're going to be making. And this is going to be happening, it says, rain or shine.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So we're doing it no matter what, but it sounds like it's going to
shine.
If we're
wrong about the weather, you just pack your boots and have a good old Juno.
Oh my gosh, it might be more memorable that way, to be honest.
That's true,
Dancing in the rain.
Dancing to the high cost of living. And I know that you have the high cost of living. I think most people in Juno know this band, but if you don't, it's like the most awesome cover band ever.
Yeah, with a horn section, and there will be four singers on Saturday.
It's a huge band.
Probably some sparkles.
If you've ever been to Folk Fest, you've seen Costa and her giant extravaganzas.
Yes.
So I'm sure she's putting together something special for this event on Saturday, which is also, and also the Yate Yi dancers. Sounds like that's going to be really awesome too. And so, Rachel, what's coming up for Jammy beyond the Jammy Jam?
Yeah, well, I'll let Taylor help me talk about this too, but our kind of culmination of the big events we've had in this most part of this year is First Friday. First Friday, we will be working with Alaska Robotics and the Alaska or Juno Reentry Coalition to highlight Recovery Month, to show some of the films that we have been making with local filmmakers that highlight and record our history over the last 40 years. So First Friday, films, fun, probably food.
Yeah.
It's going to be all there.
September 5th at Alaska Robotics.
Alaska Robotics,
a series of mini docs made by local filmmakers that have started rolling, and I'm getting to see some finished products. And Rachel saw one yesterday and said, we're going to need some tissue boxes.
We're going to need some tissues.
It's so cool.
Bring
your little
sleeves or something.
A couple of packets,
Yes.
And one more time for those who need to know the website or how to reach out to Jammy, a phone number and the website, perhaps.
Jammy.org, Jammhi.org. And our phone number, 907-463-3303.
Awesome. Again, it's this Saturday, the Jammy Jam, 4 to 7 out at Pavilion. Pioneer Pavilion over in Douglas. Thanks so much, Gwyneth Cheesh, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, up next on Juno Afternoon, we'll have Garden Talk, but first, a savory moment. Excellent.
Step in to the savory moment. Jollof rice arrived in late December. You'd been expecting the visit ever since this bright and spicy West African party dish saluted from your favorite cooking newsletter. You're always auditioning new recipes, especially warm, colorful ones, to ward off the winter winds and freezing rain on Alaska's southeast coast. Jollof rice stood on the doorstep looking like a small bonfire, announcing it would be starring in your first ever Kwanzaa celebration and that you were to gather ingredients: canned whole tomatoes, red bell pepper, a habanero, ginger, garlic, basmati rice, broth, red onion, and turmeric and smoked paprika. As for the cooking pot, you received it as a Christmas gift, a 5.5-quart Dutch oven in smoky teal. Entering the kitchen, Jollof rice swept past you and headed straight for the pot, as though they'd arranged the meeting in advance. You were advised to take notes. Jollof rice is cooked in a thick sauce, so slow bake rather than using the stovetop. Make a large quantity, because dinner guests will want seconds, but more likely thirds. Cleats and boots cast aside, your Kwanzaa guests gathered around the table where the jollof rice glowed like embers, melting all worries about black ice on the roadways. Had the pot of rice looked up, it would have seen a ring of curious faces drawing closer to its warmth and, inevitably, to each other. Looking around the table, you saw brows furrowed, as if everyone was trying to identify a secret ingredient hiding in the shadows. No one was thinking about wind or rain or the treacherous travel to come. Peace can be like that, settling between cracks when something else, like jollof rice, has your attention. You just have to open the door. Find the full recipe for Southeast Coast Jollof Rice at savorymoment.org. From the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Beth Shortroads. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
Support comes from Juno Compost, recycling the community's food scraps and yard debris into compost since 2017, serving households, businesses, offices, and more with curbside collection and drop-off options. Online at junocompost.com.
From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Mike Lane. Today is Wednesday, August 20th, and on this day back in 1957, a biblical-like plague of tiny toads invaded the municipal airport early in the morning. They're all over the place. There's millions of them, reported witnesses who saw them on the runways, in parking areas, and inside the administration building. Lack of water in the flats nearby was believed to have forced them to migrate to the airport. That's a look back at this day in 1957.
That right there is Mike Lane with his On the Day segment. You can listen to Mike every morning on Morning Edition here on KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon. Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Boston Christopher, and I'm joined now by UAF Cooperative Extension Service Agent and Associate Professor Darren Snyder. And this week's topic is making the most of your precious harvest. Proper preparation for successful storage will make all the difference. Gwyneth Cheesh, HaEUD, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to see you again. Darren Wasaiti, how are you today?
I'm well, Boston. Good to see you as well.
I love this topic because we're kind of getting to the end of the harvest, and it's like, what do we do with the stuff that we have? So where do we begin?
Yes, yes. But the good news is that there's still time to prepare, and I wanted to really emphasize that you know, you're not going to be harvesting everything just yet. But if you do want to be storing some of this, then it's a good idea to have a little bit of a plan in place. So hopefully I can help you all out with that.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Yeah, because there's certain things that you don't even get out of the garden yet, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. But I have to have tools, and I might have to have some storage containers, or I might have to have some other kinds of things. So where do we begin?
Yeah. So first off, I just wanted to share that some of my inspiration for this came from I joined the Juno Garden Club and their Gustavus tour last weekend, and we toured no less than four different root cellars, and some of them even had carrots from last year that were ready to eat. And
oh, wow.
So people are being really successful here in Southeast Alaska in successfully storing these products that usually come from our own garden, but it also can be stuff that we purchased from either a local grower or even just brought in, because this season is the season that, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, things are being harvested. And so it's an opportunity just to, you know, if you can order a lug of something or other, then you can, and you have a place to put it, then you can do it. It's like essentially, you know, essentially, when we're talking about these, you know, storage spaces such as root cellars, we're talking about something that's mimicking a refrigerator. And so you have the opportunity to be having your delicious food, you know, at your ready. You may be able to save some money by buying in bulk. When you are harvesting at peak freshness, then that's when these foods are most nutritious, and they're going to store the longest. So any of these activities that we're doing, the big idea is that we're trying to just slow them down, so that when we get to eat them in the future, in the coming weeks, months, that it does taste fresh and it's, you know, a crisp, snappy apple or a snappy carrot. It's nothing, you know, not limp and losing, its, qualities that you want.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So what do I do?
Well, first you want to make sure that you are just kind of aware of the concepts that we're working with here. And there are three main things to pay attention to. You want to pay attention to the temperature of your storage area. You want to pay attention to what the humidity is and being able to adjust the humidity as needed. And you want to make sure that there's enough airflow in any storage environment. So, first off, you got to start with the best quality produce you can. If you have, when you're harvesting, many times we'll end up, nicking a piece of fruit, or you'll notice a blemish. Those are the ones you want to eat and or give away or preserve in a different fashion than we're talking about here. And we're talking about cool storage generally.
Okay.
Again, kind of mimicking a refrigerator, so. When we're trying to make sure that this is the best produce possible, we are trying to harvest at the latest point. Granted, you don't want to have things becoming woody or anything like that. I've had kohlrabi that were just a little bit too late, and so they did start to get a little bit woody. So you should know your produce, make sure that you're harvesting stuff at peak harvest point. But generally, like with carrots, or with potatoes, you want them to take the full length season with us. Also, in making sure that you have the best quality that you can, you're taking a lot of care when you're harvesting. But when you're harvesting things like potatoes, for example, there are certain strategies, and so there's a term called just skinning up your potatoes. And so people who have raised potatoes are usually familiar with this, but if you want it to be able to store, you want there to be a skin that's going to protect it. And so that starts with your pre-harvest, where people will knock down their plants, either crimp them or roll them over or cut them off, or commercial folks sometimes burn them. But just the plant, and then you let it sit in the ground for a week or more. And generally, people cover it up here in our rainy environment so they don't absorb too much moisture and crack. But I don't want to get into the weeds too much on all the individuals, but that's one of the examples of just how you want to make sure that your specific harvests are being taken care of. And so with potatoes, you're going to, after you've had them skin up in the ground a little bit, you actually can take them out and lay them out and actually let them be in a relatively warm environment, like in the 50s, which isn't hard to get around here. But you don't want to throw it right into a cool environment like down in which we'd want to be storing these for the winter, because, again, you want it to be forming this skin. So, and as far as where you're going to be storing these things, there are lots of options there. It can be part of your house. It could be a separate structure. Some people will just store in pretty much a hole in the ground. There's buried barrels. There are so many ways that people have stored vegetables and for over the years. The different ways allow for ease of access, ease of management, and all of that, those considerations.
Yeah, when you were talking about going on the tour last weekend and seeing the root cellars, that in my mind, I imagined like something in somebody's house, like a cellar. But yeah. A root cellar could be a concept of mind, right, in terms of what it means to be a root cellar?
Yeah. It's somewhere where you store it. And so a lot of people do. You know, it's most convenient for yourself as, you know, if you're going to go and access your root cellar, if you can walk somewhere from the inside your house and go access it, that's really convenient. And if it's part of your building already, then you don't have to build something.
Right.
You just have to modify it a little bit. And so let's just say, for example, if it's somebody's literal cellar or a crawl space. A lot of us have crawl spaces. If it's a dry crawl space and, you know, it doesn't flood in the winter or anything like that, then that's a good place to start. And so we have within the Cooperative Extension some excellent resources to get some of the basics on, you know, what it would take to build a root cellar in your house. And we have a publication called Vegetable Storage and Root Cellars. And so you can see some of the concepts there. But the big idea is you want it to stay cool. And so your house is warm because you don't want to be as cold as your vegetables. So you're going to kind of insulate your roots your space for storage from the warmth of your house. And so there's insulation involved. There's also vapor barriers, because we do want, many of these we want to have a humidity of over 90%. So that's really moist. Mm. And because you don't want your vegetables to dry out, because that's what causes them, one of the things that can cause them to deteriorate. And so, but your house doesn't want to be that moist. So again, you're going to have some strategies to isolate your house environment from this storage environment.
So if I'm hearing you, I'm trying to learn. Mm-hmm. I want to do high humidity, low temperature, not freezing.
Correct.
Necessarily, but yeah, somewhere in the
cool
50s,
storage.
Right?
Well, or not, even not, just above freezing is the general.
Just above, okay, so we're talking like 35, 37?
32 to 40 for many of them.
Okay.
And the ones that are generally warmer and drier are like our garlic and onions.
Mm.
Other ones that we consider to be kind of our typical root crops, like beets and carrots and also kohlrabi and rutabagas, those all want to have that cooler. And the same thing with apples and pears and things like that.
I see. But the high moisture is really interesting. So if I don't have a house, right, mm-hmm. let's say I live in a apartment or mm-hmm. something,
mm-hmm.
And I have a garden in the community garden, you know, and I bring my stuff home,
mm-hmm.
what are some ways I might be able to accomplish sort of a mini roots cellar?
Well, that's a great question, and it's essentially kind of the answer is you really aren't really set up to do that. And that's the same thing for any sort of like food storage. It's like, you know, I also work on just emergency food storage, and we're all kind of limited in these things, but especially when you're talking about creating an environment that is like a refrigerator,
yeah,
in a small amount of space. So there are concepts. In fact, Gustavus, just to invoke that again, they have a community root cellar, and it's something that I would love to hear from folks in our community. If you want to work on a community root cellar project, please contact me, because I do too. And there are funds available for us to apply for. What we need is a little bit of groundswell for people who are interested to move forward with this type of project.
Because if we have a community garden, we might as well have a community root cellar, right?
Amen. Amen. Yeah. There are lots of opportunities with that.
So, awesome. Yeah. Okay. And other things about this, storing our harvests?
Yeah. So when you're managing your, you want to, and the, again, the timing on this, I do want people to just be thinking about, well, is there a place in my home? Is there a place in my friend's home? Is there a place where I can think of that is, you know, first off, going to be a safe place? It's going to be, it's, you know, well built. It's not going to have rodents or other pests that are going to be something that they're going to come in. Something that's accessible by me in the wintertime. All those factors. Try and think about, are there any places like that? And also go ahead and gather up, like you were talking about right at the beginning, you know, some of your materials, some of your supplies, what type of bins, using wooden crates, using even plastic totes works as, depending on how you're doing this. But some of the supplies standard would be clean sawdust, something that's not from a chainsaw, which spits out oil, but more of a bandsaw, that type of sawdust, which is just straight sawdust, and generally hardwoods, not our conifers, because the conifers, unless it's really old sawdust, will actually off-gas some volatile, you know, it smells piney, and that will flavor things.
And then
gathering all these things up, learning more about it, now's the time to be doing that. Please look me up at the Cooperative Extension Service here in Juneau. Also, I just wanted to just acknowledge that there are many experts, but a specific expert up in the Fairbanks area who's been sharing with our state. His name is Sam Knapp. He has a book called Beyond the Root Cellar, and he's got a cool farm up in Fairbanks called Offbeat Farm. And so he's actually a producer who is really focused on the niche market of what are the storable crops that he as a farmer could produce. And so it'd be a good combination. So if people want to get into it, give me a call.
And give your information, Darren, because I know you also mentioned you have a pamphlet that might be available.
Yes.
In terms of how to store your vegetables. Where do we reach out and find some of this information?
Yeah, look up Juneau Cooperative Extension Service. Juno Cooperative Extension Service. You can get our general email there. And then as well, we've talked about the cool storage. There's also many other types of food preservation techniques, whether it be freezing, canning, and such. And so we'll talk about maybe bringing on my colleague Sarah Lewis, who focuses on that as related to our garden harvests in the future as well.
Excellent. Okay. Well, Gwyneth Cheesh, for being here, thank you so much. This week's topic, making the most of your precious harvest. Proper preparation for successful storage makes all the difference. Darren Snyder, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Boston.
That's the Nude and Rude Review with Vivi Brown's Shark in the Water, live from the red carpet stage right here in the studio at KTOO. That's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives at KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you. Never more important than now. and Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh, have a lovely Juno evening.